Gaius Primus. He was one of the first citizens to speak out publicly against slavery, you know.
Tavi shook his head.
I didn't. He had a habit of making allies of his enemies, Araris said. You should have seen the brawls he had with Antillus Raucus at the academy, but they ended as friends. He had a kind of grace about him. He could face a man down without taking his pride. If he'd lived, he would have... Araris's voice closed off for a moment. He cleared his throat and said, Everything would be different. If, Tavi said. The word carried far more weight than it should have. Bitterness, longing, sadness. Araris squinted out at the ocean. And he loved your mother more than air and light. He defied his father's direct command when he wed her. Gaius had other ideas about who would make him a suitable wife. Tavi cleared his throat.
Do you think he would have been a good father?
He would have loved you, Araris said at once.
He frowned.
But he would have been busy making things better?
Araris was silent for a long time.
Perhaps, he said, the word coming out reluctantly. Great Furies know there was a distance enough between him and his own father. But perhaps not. Children can change a man like few other things can.
Araris offered Tavi a flask, and Tavi accepted it. More tepid water, but at least he felt like it would stay down this time.
Have you given any thought to what we're doing? Araris asked.
Tavi frowned.
Of course.
Araris shook his head.
I know you've been planning it. You've thought about what we're doing and how. You've thought about what was to be gained or lost. But I wonder if you've given much consideration to the why of it.
Tavi felt a flash of uncertainty, followed hard by anger. He swallowed both with the next mouthful of water and said,
Because it's going to save lives. It might, Araris said, nodding. But I wonder if you have the right to make this choice. I'd approach Gaius, Tavi said, but for whatever reason he's out of reach. I've already tried to contact him via my coin, Aaron too.
From what you told me, you already did ask him about seeking a diplomatic solution, Araris said.
And he flatly denied you.
That was before he knew all the details.
Which gives you the right to decide policy that's going to have a great many repercussions? Leaving aside the legality of what you're attempting is going to be viewed very badly from a great many directions, even if you're totally successful.
Tavi sighed. You think I'm overstepping my authority as a cursor?
I know you're doing that, Araris replied. I question whether or not you're overstepping your new authority.
What difference does it make?
Your claim to that authority is based upon authority derived from the law and from principles of justice, Araris said, his voice quiet and intent. If you begin your new role by spitting on that law, those principles, you're undermining your own position, eroding the ethical foundations from which your authority should derive.
Tavi heard himself chuckle quietly.
Believe it or not, I've thought of that.
Araris tilted his head slightly to one side, listening.
What I learned from Nasorg, and the opportunity that it created, is clearly information of critical importance. It would probably influence Gaius's reasoning very strongly, certainly enough to force him to reconsider his earlier decision. Agreed?
Araris nodded once. Tavi turned to face him.
But he's gone. I don't know where he is or what he's doing, but for the purposes of this crisis he's been incapacitated. Normally, if that happened, we'd consult with whoever was next in the chain of command, and then that person would make the decision.
Araris made a small, skeptical sound.
That's quite a shaky foundation.
Tavi half grinned.
I know, he said quietly. But if I'm to be what I was meant to be,
It means that I have a responsibility to this realm and its people, and if I don't act, it's going to be a real nightmare. He put a hand on Araris's shoulder. You ask me how I can possibly justify doing this, but the real question is this. How can I possibly justify doing nothing? Araris stared at him for a moment, then shook his head and snorted. They turned back to stare at the ocean again, and Tavi asked, I need you. Be honest with me. Are you against this?
I was against you rushing in without being sure of your own motives, he replied. Your father was a good man, but he had a tendency to trust his instincts too much, to act without thinking. He leaned on his power to get him out of any problems that arose.
Not really an issue with me, Tavi murmured. Araris laughed quietly.
No, you're stronger than he was. He mused for a moment, and probably more dangerous.
Tavi hardly knew how to respond to that. He lapsed into silence for another several minutes. Then he asked, Your opinion. Can we do it? Araris replied without hesitation,
I don't see how it's possible.
Tavi grunted and chewed on his lip. Araris sighed and spoke with reluctance.
But that's never really stopped you before, has it?
Tavi barked out a short laugh, and he saw Araris smile beside him.
You should get some sleep, Araris said. You'll need it. Practice tomorrow.
Practice? Tavi asked.
Araris Valerian nodded.
You've got your basics with the sword. You're ready for some serious training.
Tavi blinked. He had thought himself, well, quite skilled with a blade.
Do you really think that's necessary?
Araris laughed.
Your father used to ask me the same thing.
What did you tell him?
As you wish, my lord, Araris responded.
His smile faded,
and someone killed him. So you're practicing tomorrow and every day after, and you'll keep it up until I'm satisfied.
When will that be?
When you can beat me, Araris said.
He bowed his head to Tavi and nodded toward the cabin.
Get some rest, my lord.
Chapter 24
Isana watched as Tavi's bare back slammed into the bulkhead of the Slive's cabin for the 9th time in 30 minutes. The young man bounced back wheezing, but his sword kept moving, catching and turning 2 slashes and sliding aside a long thrust from his opponent. He wasn't quite fast enough, though, and a string of scarlet beads appeared along one of his ribs. Isana winced, more at the flash of frustration and chagrin that came from Tavi than from any sympathy for his pain. The wound was a minor one, and Isana could close it without trouble, after practice. It wouldn't even scar. Araris would never inflict anything more serious upon any student, much less upon this one. Tavid had the wind knocked out of him, and it showed when he let out a weak yell and pressed a furious attack against Araris. The Singulare blocked every single attack, seemingly by the barest of margins, then made a peculiar circular motion of his wrist. Tavi's sword rolled abruptly from his grasp and fell to the deck. Tavi didn't wait a second, pressing in close and getting a grip on Araris's sword arm. He slammed his forehead against Araris's cheekbone and drove a hard blow into his ribs with another yell. Isana tensed suddenly, half rising, as she sensed the wave of pure anger now rolling from her son. Araris absorbed the blows like an anvil. They simply impacted him to no apparent effect. He seized the wrist of Tavi's gripping arm with his own free hand, then turned, weight shifting in a little up-and-down bobbing motion. Tavi, drawn suddenly off balance, flipped entirely over, and Araris guided his back down onto the wooden deck. He hit hard enough to make Isana wince again, but not, she was certain, as hard as he could have. Tavi lay there on the deck, blinking up at the sails and the sky, stunned. The sailors, most of whom had been watching the practice, let out a chorus of cheers, jeers, and advice, accompanied by more than a little laughter.
Temper, Araris said, his voice steady. He wasn't so much as breathing hard. You're a naturally aggressive fighter, but anger is not your ally in a match like this. You've got to keep yourself centered and thinking. Use the anger. Don't let it use you.
He sheathed his sword and offered Tavi a hand up. The younger man glowered at the older for a moment, then shook his head and took his hand.
What was that wrist lock? He wheezed. I've never seen that one before.
It's fairly simple, Araris replied. You've had enough for one day, though. I'll show you tomorrow if you like.
I'm all right, Tavi said. Show me now.
Araris tilted his head, his lips pursed in thought, then suddenly grinned.
As you wish.
Get some water and we'll go another round. If you can keep your head, I'll show you the lock and the counter.
Tavi recovered his sword from the deck, saluted Araris, and sheathed it. Then he walked over to the water barrel beside where Asana sat on a small folding stool. He smiled at her, dunked a wooden cup into the water, and drank it all down, followed by a second. In the 2 days since he'd begun recovering from his seasickness, his color had returned, and he'd been shoveling down enough food for two at mealtimes, despite the rather questionable provender to be had from the Slive's cook. Tavi and Araris were sparring shirtless, apparently to keep Tavi from having all of his shirts cut to ribbons and stained with blood. Isana had been studiously avoiding staring at Araris. She would not have thought that a man of his age would look so athletic without the use of watercraft, but he was very nearly as lean as Tavi, his body hard with flat, ropey muscle. Of course he'd spent all those years in the forge back at the Steadholt, and she'd once seen him practicing there by the light of dying embers late one night, using an iron bar in place of an actual weapon. Araris had grown confident and strong again, no longer the broken man he'd become after Septimus's death, and seeing him like that was both immensely gratifying to Asana and more than a little distracting. Her fingertips almost itched with the raw desire to trace those muscles. Instead, she turned back to her sewing, mending one of Kitai's pairs of trousers, where both her eyes and her fingers would have less trouble behaving in an appropriate manner.
"Would you like me to close that for you?" she asked Tavi quietly. "I won't need a tub for something that small."
Tavi glanced at her, and a complex little cloud of emotions drifted around him for a second. Then he shook his head and closed down on them, until Isana could no longer sense anything except for a vague dissatisfaction.
"No, thank you. It's not leaking anymore."
The words came out with a small, harsh edge. He gave her a guilty little glance, and then a half-forced smile appeared on his face.
"Though at the rate I'm going, I might need you to patch up my pride."
Aaron appeared from within the cabin in time to say, waving vaguely at the sea, "I don't think there's enough water available." Tavi arched an eyebrow.
"Why don't you come practice with us and say that again, little man?"
Aaron raised a modest hand. "Thank you. No. I get confused about which end of the sword I should hold. I wouldn't dream of slowing down the advanced class." He turned the gesture into a mocking little fencer's salute and strode off toward the back of the ship, presumably to speak with their captain again.
"Some annoying little person is going to get thrown into the drink some day," Tavi called after him.
Then he shook his head, grinning, and turned back to Araris. Isana watched between stitches. She knew barely enough about swordplay to be able to watch it, but it seemed to her that Tavi was moving more slowly but also more certainly. She caught a flicker of satisfaction from Araris as the young man defended against half a dozen swift strokes. Kitai's voice suddenly rang out from the rigging above.
"Sails!" she called. "Dead ahead!"
Men paused in their work. A thrill of apprehension flashed through the air, brushing against Isana like a frozen cobweb. Immediately Deimos's voice began calling out brusque orders, and he swarmed up the ropes into the rigging himself, moving as nimbly as a squirrel through the lines. Isana watched as he gained the crow's nest, where Kitai pointed out something to him. Deimos held up his hands in a gesture Isana had often seen used by windcrafters to magnify their view of different objects. He stared for a moment. Then he came swinging back down through the rigging and dropped the last 10 feet to the deck. He shouted more orders, and the ship suddenly pitched sharply to its right. Men scrambled to readjust the sails, while Deimos strode back and forth, shouting terms and commands so obscure and confusing to Isana that he might as well have been speaking another language. Isana rose and walked calmly to Deimos's side, once the initial stream of orders trickled off. "Captain," she said, "what's happening?" Isana took note that Tavi and Eren had stepped over closer to her as Deimos answered.
"That's the Mactis out there," he said, his tone calm. "Red Gallus's ship."
He stared out over the waves at a gleam of white sailcloth in the far distance.
"I ordered a change of course. Now we'll see what he does."
"Skipper!"
called a man from the ship's wheel.
"He's changing course to intercept!"
"Bloody crows," Deimos sighed. "Lady, I recommend that you and yours get into your cabin and stay there."
"Why?" Isana said. "What's happening?"
"The captain of the Mactus thinks he's a pirate," Deimos replied. "The fool means to board us."
Isana felt her eyes grow very wide. "Oh?" "Can he catch us, Captain?" Tavi asked. Deimos nodded once.
"Likely. He picked his position pretty well. The wind is taking us into him. He's got a good current, and Gallus knows this part of the business. Give us a few more leagues, and he might turn back."
"Why would he do that?" Eren asked.
"Because I'm sailing for the run."
Eren froze in his tracks and blinked at Deimos.
"What?"
Tavi frowned and asked in a completely different tone, "What?"
"The Leviathans run,"
Eren told Tavi. He licked his lips nervously.
"It's a stretch of ocean where,
"Leviathans," Tavi said. "I get it."
"Not exactly," Deimos said.
He sounded almost bored.
"It's where young males who haven't staked out their own territory tend to congregate."
"Oh," Tavi said. "What do they do there?"
"What every group of young males does," Deimos replied. "Fight each other for no good reason. Charge around blindly at full speed just for the crows of it."
"And smash ships to tiny pieces," Eren added in a very small voice. Deimos grunted agreement and turned to the rail again.
"My witch men are better than his. Let's see if he wants to roll the dice today."
"Captain," Tavi said, "no offense, but have you given thought to, well, taking him on?"
"No," Deimos said. "The Slive is half the size of the Mactus, and Gallus carries extra swordsmen to boot. 3-1 odds aren't the kind I like."
"We've got some fairly capable hands ourselves," Tavi said. Deimos looked at him and barked out a short, harsh laugh.
"Kid, you're pretty good. But there's a long way between training sessions with a family swordmaster and spilling blood on a rolling deck."
"He's right," Araris said quietly, stepping up to stand behind Tavi. "This fight is better avoided." Deimos looked past Tavi to the older man.
"You've fought at sea before?"
"Yes." Araris didn't elaborate. Deimos nodded once.
"Listen to your teacher, kid, and get comfortable. It's going to be a couple of hours before we get this sorted out, either way. Excuse me. I need to make sure my witch men aren't drunk again."
Deimos strode off to the stairway down to the hold and descended smoothly.
"That was a joke, right?" Eren said. "About the water crafters?"
Isana frowned. She could feel a rising anxiety pouring from the young cursor. His arms were folded, and one of Eren's feet drummed nervously on the wooden deck. Tavi noted Eren's worry as well.
"What's got you so twitchy?" he asked.
"If you'd ever actually seen..." Eren licked his lips.
"I'm going to go rifle the bosun's trunk. Bound to be something to drink in there. You want any?"
Tavi frowned.
"No, I'm fine."
Eren jerked his head in a quick nod and glanced at Araris and Isana.
"Sir?
Lady?" They declined, and Eren scurried away, his face quite pale. Tavi watched him go, frowning, and then went to the ship's railing. He stood staring out at the ocean for a time and occasionally stepped away to pace up and down the rail. After perhaps half an hour, he stalked over to Asana's side and frowned down at her.
"How can you just sit there sewing?" he asked.
Asana didn't look up from her work.
"Is there something else I should be doing?"
Tavi folded his arms, frowning.
"The captain said you should get into the cabin."
"He said we all should," Asana responded. "But I don't see you going there." Tavi frowned at her.
"Well, I should be on deck."
"So that someone can trip over you?" Asana asked. She tried not to smile. She honestly did, but felt it on her mouth, despite her efforts.
"Or perhaps you think your sword is going to be of use in trimming sails,
or warding leviathans away." He let out an exasperated breath.
"At least as useful as your sewing."
Asana set the sewing down and regarded her son steadily.
"It's going to be hours before anything happens, and it's a lovely day. From the level of anxiety I'm sensing from the crew and Aaron, they expect that we might well be crushed by a leviathan and dragged into the depths of the sea. Failing that, we can look forward to a desperate struggle against a band of pirates who outnumber us 3-1.
She turned back to her task. "In either circumstance, the light would be less than ideal for sewing. So I think I'll sit here on the deck and enjoy the sunshine while I may, if that's quite all right with you." Tavi stared at her, and she could feel his complete shock quite clearly. She spared him a small smile. "I know you're worried about me, and I know how much you've always hated it, that so many things were entirely out of your control. This is another such thing. Denying that won't make it less true." He looked down at her for a moment, frowning, his mood turning from restive impatience to pensive introspection. Asana had always found her son's ability to focus upon whatever he set his mind on to be somewhat intimidating. He could pour tremendous energy of thought and will into any given task. It must be uncomfortable for him, to say the least, to turn that same focus inward. He sighed and settled down on the deck beside her stool, resting his shoulders against the bulkhead behind them. He lowered his voice.
"If I had
the Fury craft, yes," she said quietly. "It hasn't solved the First Lord's problems. Even if you had it, you'd merely be faced with a host of different uncontrollable situations." Tavi was quiet for a moment. Then he said,
"But I could protect you."
"Perhaps," she said quietly. "Perhaps not. Life is not notable for its overabundance of certainty." Tavi grimaced and nodded.
"I just thought I'd feel better if you were inside."
She tied off the thread, willed Rill into a fingernail to sharpen it, and cut it neatly. She slipped the needle through thread still wound on the spool and shook her hand gently as the nail returned to normal, stretching her aching fingers. "If you truly think that's best, perhaps you should try leading us there." He blinked and tilted his head, looking at her. She laughed. She couldn't help it. She leaned down and kissed his hair. For all that he was grown so tall, and for all that he had learned and become, she could still see the infant, the toddler, the mischievous child, all rolled into the man he was becoming. "Consider," she said. "Were Gaius in your position?"
"As if he'd ever be without Fury craft," Tavi snorted.
"But if he were," Asana pressed, meeting his eyes, "consider it. How would his retinue react to him, If he stood brooding on the rail and paced about like a hungry Thanodent, snarling and giving orders that made little sense?" Tavi scowled at her. He began to speak, stopped, then shrugged.
"If I was there with him, I'd be worried."
"Quite," Asana said. "Such a display might soothe his own anxiety, but he would be doing so at a cost to others. Is that the kind of person you want to be?" Tavi tilted his head again, frowning. He said nothing. "Now consider. If staying locked in the passenger cabin truly was the wisest course of action, would you rush into it if it seemed that Gaius was determined to stay on deck despite the futility of the gesture?"
"Probably not," Asana nodded.
"That's because Gaius, for all that he is a manipulative old serpent, is also a leader. He acts, others follow. She glanced around and said, "They follow you, too."
Tavi's brow furrowed. "What do you mean?"
"Those with us," she said. "Even many of the sailors. They recognize intelligence, competence, confidence. They regard you and your evaluation of our situation with more respect than they would another."
Tavi chewed on his lower lip and murmured, "I'm frightening them."
Isana saw no need to confirm what Tavi had finally realized. "If Gaius thought his people were all safest in the cabin, what do you think he would do?"
Tavi nodded slowly.
"He'd go there. Give them a chance to protest. Save their pride. Help their morale. If he thought that was best."
Isana reached into the garment bag on the deck beside her and drew out one of Aaron's sets of trousers, all of which bore tears and ham-handed repairs that were arguably worse than the rips they'd replaced.
"Well then, it might be wise for you to practice. What do you think is the best thing to do?"
Her son shook his head. "That question has been on my mind a lot lately."
Here it came. She steeled herself against another reflex flutter of panic. That wasn't what Tavi needed right now.
"Oh? It's a lot," he said.
"Yes."
"It's big," Isana nodded.
"Oh, yes,"
he whispered.
"I'm scared."
Isana closed her eyes. The man's voice spoke with the child's aching fear, and it hurt to hear it, to feel it.
"The thing is," he said quietly, "that I'm not making this choice just for me. If I'm not killed today, or when we get to the capital, or in the fighting after that, or in the trial after the fighting, then what I do will affect a lot of people."
"That isn't precisely uncommon over the past few years," she pointed out.
"But this is different. This is more, is it?"
Tavi looked up at her, searching her eyes with his. They looked brilliantly green against the dark brown wood stain of the ship's timbers.
"What if I can't handle it?" he said quietly. "What if I'm not capable of it?"
"Tavi, you've never needed—"
"This isn't about Furycraft," he said quietly, firmly. "It's about me."
He leaned closer, whispering.
"Do you think I could do this? Take his place?"
Isana's heart pounded. She set the trousers aside. The fear screamed at her to tell her son no, that he could not possibly enter the insanity that passed for government in Alera and survive, that he would bungle whatever he set his hand to, cause pain and grief to untold thousands. Instead, she took his hand and held it in both of hers.
"I've had nightmares about this since you were an infant," Isana said quietly. "Every time you did something that attracted the attention of the crown, every time you threw yourself into harm's way for another, it felt like someone stabbing me with a knife. I was sure that if you kept it up, your father's enemies would see you, recognize you, kill you. That's all I could see."
She looked up at his eyes.
"But I didn't see what was right in front of me."
She clenched his hand hard, and her voice turned fierce.
"You have proven, again and again, that you are his son. His son! Never let anyone tell you differently."
He stared at her with wide eyes. Then he nodded once, and his jawline suddenly firmed.
"Thank you."
"Great Furies don't thank me for this," she said quietly. "I hate it. I hate everything about it."
"Will you stand with me?" he asked.
She leaned down and clasped him, hugging him as tightly as she could, and whispered,
"Hail, Gaius Octavian."
Chapter 25. Tavi stood in the very bow of the ship, where he would be out of the way of any of the sailors laboring to coax every bit of speed from the Slive. The ship leapt forward through the waves, and salt spray occasionally misted over him. He felt Kitai's presence a breath before he heard her bare feet tread quietly on the deck behind him. She stepped up beside him, casually pressing her side against his, and followed his gaze off to the ship's port side. There, visible even from the level of the deck now, was the recognizable shape of another ship, its sails gleaming white in the afternoon sun, its course steadily converging on theirs.
"They're going to catch up," Kitai said quietly.
"So it would seem," Tarvi said. "The crew's getting anxious. They'll start sharpening their knives before much longer."
Kitai nodded. "I feel it, too."
She was silent for a time more and said, "Do these pirates always attack so far out at sea? It seems to me to be a troublesome way to seek a quarrel. We could have fought on the docks and settled it there. Then we could have enjoyed the voyage in peace."
"That would have been far more reasonable," Tarvi agreed. "But I'm afraid they aren't reasonable people."
"No, they're Alarans."
She shook her head, and Tarvi suddenly noticed the absence of the usual good-humored twinkle in her eye when she made such observations.
"Charla, there is something you should see."
Tarvi nodded and followed her the length of the deck to a narrow staircase that led down into the dimly lit hold of the ship. Within, the ship looked like any rough wooden building except for the odd contours of the outer wall and the low ceiling. They went through what looked like a larder full of boxes and barrels of foodstuffs and a small workshop where various woodworking tools were stored, along with spare lumber, evidently for repairs. Beyond that, the workshop doors opened into the cargo hold. It was damp and musty, lit with only a single pair of tiny fury lamps. The wooden beams of the ship creaked and groaned around them. Kitai slipped forward through the mostly empty hold until they reached the foremost part, just under where Tarvi had been standing a few moments before. There, the flat planks forming the floor of the hold had been left out, exposing the curve of the ship's hull, a space the size of a couple of large bathtubs that was full of what was apparently seawater. A pair of men knelt in the water. Both of them were bare-chested, and both had long hair worn in an odd style of dozens and dozens of tiny braids. Their skin was marked with dark ink, formed into abstract swirls and curling patterns. Both men had their eyes closed, their hands spread with fingers wide in the seawater, and they both kept up a constant murmuring under their breath. Their skin had a shriveled look, and they shuddered with the cold.
"The witchmen," Tarvi murmured.
"No," Kitai said. "Not them."
Tarvi arched an eyebrow at her.
"I asked Deimos to show me these witchmen," she said. She walked over to the thick shadows at one side of the hold. "That was when I noticed these."
Tarvi followed her, squinting. It was difficult to make out anything in the thick shadows, but his night vision had improved markedly since the bond had formed between him and Kitai. She waited in patient silence for a moment until his eyes adjusted, and he saw what she had brought him to see. Chains. Four heavy rings had been set into the side of the ship, spaced about a foot apart, 4 feet up from the floor. From each set of rings dangled 2 sets of manacles, heavy things that could never be broken without fury-assisted strength, and anyone locked into them would perforce be surrounded by the wooden hull of the ship and cut off from contact with the earth. The hull of the ship and the floor there beneath the rings was stained, and Tarvi was glad that he couldn't see much of it. A faint scent lingered in the air beneath the mustiness of the ship itself, the foulness of human waste and blood. That was easily enough seen, dark blotches on the manacles.
"Deimos is a slaver," Kitai said quietly.
Tarvi took a step back before he took a deep breath. "It isn't uncommon in this part of the world. Most captains have transported slaves at one time or another."
Kitai reached out and touched a chain, running her fingers down the links.
"And you see nothing wrong with that?"
"I don't like it," Tarvi said. "But men like Deimos choose what jobs they will or will not take."
Kitai gave Tarvi a rather hard look.
"Not that, Alarin. Do you see nothing wrong with the fact that this..."
She flicked the chain hard against the ship's hull.
"Is not uncommon?"
Tarvi blinked and stared at her for a moment.
"Kitai."
She turned back to Tarvi, her eyes narrowed. You told me that Nasog called your kind monsters. So would my people if they knew you treated your own like this.
Not everyone does, Tavi said.
But everyone allows it, she said, her voice hard. She stepped forward until he could see her features in the dimness. They were green agates. Is this what you are as well, Alaron?
He met her eyes for a moment and felt her outrage like the heat of a fire on his face. He began to speak, but stopped. Instinct warned him that nothing he said would answer her question. Instead, he closed his eyes for a moment and dropped his hand to the hilt of his sword. He reached out to it, sensing the strength of the steel, feeling its latent energy, partially beaten into shape at a legion forge. Tavi pressed his senses into the sword, taking steady breaths, drawing his thoughts into focus, and drawing the power of the sword with them, shaping it, aligning its matter, strengthening its edge. Then he opened his eyes, stepped, drew, and swept the weapon in a single sweep and backstroke. Sparks flew up, metal screeched, and the chains clattered to the flooring, the ends of the severed links aglow with heat. Tavi sheathed the weapon in a smooth, practiced motion and turned to Kitai. The Marat girl lifted her chin, her eyes aglow. She nodded once, the motion deep enough to be almost a bow. Tavi responded the same way, never looking away from her eyes.
That, she said, is my Alaron.
Tavi looked up to find that both witchmen had turned and were staring at him. If Captain Deimos asks, Tavi told them quietly, tell him to take it up with me. The witchmen glanced at one another and then nodded to Tavi in unison. Suddenly there was a surge of emotion from above, a sudden wave of sharply increased panic, fear, and anger. It crashed against Tavi, and his balance wavered beneath the force of it. His hand went of its own accord toward Kitai, landing on her shoulder, steadying himself, even as she shuddered and reached out to brace herself against his chest. The witchmen both let out quiet moans of misery and crouched even lower in the water. They resumed their murmuring, though it was louder now, faster, almost frantic. Above, on the deck, there was an agonized scream. Tavi turned and sprinted for the stairs again, Kitai on his heels. He didn't draw his blade, a fine mess he would make of himself if he lost his balance in the ship's roll and gutted himself on his own sword. He came onto the deck to find it in frantic activity, men hurrying back and forth as the ship's officers shouted commands. All of them were crouching, darting from place to place, and casting frantic glances to port.
Careful, Araris called.
He had his shoulders pressed up against the mainmast on the starboard side.
The pirates have a night flora with them. Crow-begotten good one, too.
Tavi nodded and ducked to one side, putting the solid wood of the cabin between himself and the oncoming Mactus. He swept a quick glance around the deck and asked Araris,
"Where is she?"
There was another scream, this time up in the rigging, and a man plummeted from above to land on the deck 10 feet away. An arrow had transfixed his throat, bloodied point emerging from one side of his neck. His hips and one arm were bent at an unnatural angle, and the sailor made a few frantic gurgling sounds, feebly thrashing as his blood pooled on the deck. Araris drew his sword, his jaw tight with anger.
"Not in the cabin. She must be forward."
The door to the cabin opened, and Aaron poked his sandy-haired head out of it, looking blearily around.
"What? What's going on?"
There was a hiss, a cracking sound, and another arrow smashed through the cabin's door, just above its latch, and so close to Aaron's hand that its haft touched the bare skin of his wrist. Aaron peered owlishly at the arrow.
"Ah,"
he said, and shut the door once more. Tavi glanced at the arrow and recognized the distinctive fletching again.
"Crows take it," he snarled. "Iris the Hawk. Navaris and the rest of Arnas's thugs are out there."
There was another scream from the rigging, though at least no one fell to the deck this time. Kitai leaned around Tavi and peered to port for a moment.
400 yards at least. This archer is quite skilled." Tavi called out to Araris and told him what he had seen. The Singulare let out a sulphurous curse.
How did they catch up to us?
They must have used Arnas's Knight's Heiress, Tavi replied. They could have learned the ship's identity, and it wouldn't be too hard to figure out where we're headed. They got in front of us, flew down the coast until they found a captain willing to intercept us.
This is going to get complicated, Araris said. Stay there. I'll go find Isana.
We go together, Tavi said.
He didn't give Araris a chance to argue. He just darted forward, moving quickly down the deck. He shot one swift glance off to port to see the Mactus under sail. At this distance, he could make out the moving shapes of the crew, but he couldn't make out any details. That was good news, at least. It meant Arnas's woodcrafter couldn't pick out specific targets. She was shooting at motions and outlines, not at particular men. Tavi went forward, crouched as low as he could get, hurrying as much as he could, and had no doubt that the motion looked more ridiculous than was probably appropriate for a Princeps of Alera on the edge of battle. An arrow flashed by several feet away. One of the feathers must have been loose and dragged the shot wide, because it made an odd buzzing sound as it flew past him. Tavi crouched even lower and moved even more quickly. To the crows with dignity. He felt more than willing to live with such humiliations, especially when he might not, without them. The Mactus was steadily closing. They reached the bow and found Isana there, crouched behind the wooden planking of the prow. Tavi rushed forward and threw himself down beside her. Araris and Kitai were hard on his heels. Isana flinched as Tavi landed, but when she looked back at him, he felt a surge of relief flash through her, only to be replaced with renewed anxiety an instant later.
"Are you hurt?"
"I'm fine," Tavi said. "We've got a problem."
Isana lifted a dark eyebrow, her voice dry.
"Oh, dear."
"Arnos's knights are on that ship," Araris said, his mouth set in a tight line.
Isana's back stiffened.
"I see. Can we escape them?"
Araris crouched and lifted his head up for a moment, peering over the ship's rail, and ducked down again.
"I'm not much of a sailor, but I doubt it.
Their captain isn't going to turn back because we're sailing into the Leviathan's run," Tavi said grimly.
"Navaris wouldn't let him."
"We have to fight, then," Isana said. "Can we beat them?"
Tavi glanced at Araris.
The man shook his head.
"Not if we're outnumbered as badly as Deimos believes. Navaris is extremely skilled. I'll have to focus on her completely."
"If we can't run and we can't fight, what can we do?" Isana asked.
"We find some way to change the rules," Tavi said.
He rose for a quick peek at the other ship, then glanced quickly at the sea ahead of them. He started to drop down again when he froze, staring. Ahead of the ship, the relatively calm seas were washing against slate-gray rocks that rose 7 or 8 feet up out of the waters. There were perhaps 2 dozen of them, any one of them large enough to smash open the Slive's hull like the lid of an ale keg, should the ship collide with them.
"Captain!" Tavi bellowed. "Rocks ahead! Captain Deimos! Rocks ahead!"
Some of the crew took up the call, relaying it back along the length of the ship. Seconds later, Deimos hurried down the deck, crouching low the way Tavi had done it, though the ship's captain moved far more swiftly and confidently than Tavi had.
"Deimos!" Tavi called. "Rocks!"
The captain frowned and moved forward, rising to look.
"Scipio,"
shouted Aaron's voice from somewhere at the ship's stern.
"Where are you?"
"The bow,"
Tavi called.
"Get up here and—"
Tavi broke off as Deimos's calloused hand clamped suddenly over his mouth.
"Quiet,"
said the captain, his voice and face unreadable. He let out a pair of sharp single whistles, and the sounds of sailors talking and calling out to one another abruptly stopped. Tavi pushed Deimos's hand away, staring at him, and lowered his voice.
"Why?"
"Because those aren't rocks," Deimos said calmly. "They're leviathans."
Chapter 26.
"Oh, dear," Isana breathed.
Deimos, like Tavi, was capable of concealing his emotions. or perhaps he simply didn't feel them with any particular intensity. Either way, Isana had been able to discern very little about the man's state of mind at any point during their voyage. Right now, Deimos was radiating a cold, carefully restrained fear. He stared ahead for a few seconds more, then waved his arm in some kind of signal. The timbers of the Slive creaked, and the ship changed course slightly.
"Will we get by them?" Isana heard Tavi ask.
"We might, if we're quiet. This time of the day they come up to the warm waters at the surface to bask. Provided people don't start shouting," he gave Tavi a deliberate look, "and that we don't actually bump into one of them and wake him up. The witch men should let us tiptoe past."
Tavi narrowed his eyes, his brow furrowing.
"What if we didn't have the witch men?"
Deimos shrugged.
"We'd wish we did. Briefly."
Tavi nodded, his eyes flicking around. Isana watched as a sudden wolfish grin appeared on his face, accompanied by a surge of excitement. Kitai, who had been facing away from Tavi, peeking at the enemy vessel and the leviathans in turn, suddenly turned around, and Isana was startled by her expression, a grin that matched Tavi's as perfectly as the green of her eyes.
"I like that, Alaren," Kitai said. "Do it."
Tavi nodded and turned to Isana.
"I'm going to need your help."
Isana frowned at Tavi and then nodded once.
"To do what?"
Her son glanced aside at the Mactus, his eyes narrowed.
"Change the rules."
Deimos finished securing the straps of a heavy canvas harness around Isana's waist.
"Too tight?" he asked.
"I have no idea," Isana replied.
Deimos grunted.
"As long as you can breathe, it should be fine."
He held up a line knotted to a metal clip. He showed it to her, then slapped the clip against a metal ring on the harness and gave it a firm tug.
"In these waters you can only see about 10 feet. Remember that the Mactus is moving forward, so you aren't just moving toward her. You've got to aim ahead of her on an angle."
Isana nodded. "I'll be able to find the ship. I'm not worried about that." She leaned out around the corner of the cabin and peeked at the enemy ship, now less than 200 yards away. He attached a second line to another ring.
"Make sure you're at least 10 feet down when you do," Deimos warned her. "If that archer sees you coming, you'll get to experience bow fishing from the soggy end. Go beneath the ship to the far side before you come up. Believe me, they'll have all their attention focused on us."
"Why does it seem like you've been involved in this sort of thing before, Captain?"
"Well, it has never actually happened, of course. I have made a number of plans in the event that I should ever work with a customer who wished his cargo to be loaded or offloaded without troubling a customs inspector or harbor master."
He tested the knots on the lines.
"It is in that spirit of preparedness that I had these made for my witchmen. Though, I admit, they usually tow crates, not people."
The cabin door opened, and Tavi, Kitai, Araris, and Aaron came hurrying around the corner. Araris's sword was in his hand, and as he came it flashed in the lowering sun and shattered yet another arrow. The enemy archer had not slackened her pace, and her shafts only became more accurate as the distance closed. A dozen sailors now lay wounded or dead.
"Can't someone else do this?" Aaron asked.
"We need a woodcrafter, Aaron," Tavi said. "You're it."
"This will be just like the time you helped us escape that warehouse," Kitai said. "Except for the leviathans," Aaron sputtered.
"Quiet," hissed several people.
"Actually, your real worry is the sharks," Deimos murmured, his tone practical. "There are always dozens of sharks around leviathans, and we're about to start passing through them."
Aaron's face turned white.
"Come on, Aaron,"
Kitai said. She stripped out of her tunic and kicked off her shoes without a trace of self-consciousness.
"Be a man."
Aaron blinked and spots of color appeared on his cheeks as he turned his head away and coughed.
"Oh, bloody crows!"
He glowered at Tavi and demanded,
"Why do I keep on following you into this kind of thing?"
"You must enjoy it," Tavi said.
"I must be an idiot,"
Aaron responded. But he, along with Tavi and Araris, also began stripping down.
Let me get this straight. We hold on to the ropes, the steadholder drags us over there underwater, I open up a hole in the hull and we eliminate their witchmen. Then we run back here and sail away while the leviathans eat them.
Yes, Tavi said.
How long are we going to be under?
Araris asked quietly.
I've never done this before, Isana said.
If I was alone, it might take me half a minute to move the distance. Perhaps a little more.
Double it, Deimos said, glancing away from Kitai. At least.
He lowered a rope carefully over the side.
Are you not going to strip down, lady? That dress is going to drag quite a bit in the water.
Isana arched an eyebrow at him.
I assure you, Captain, it won't slow me.
Ah, he said, nodding. Try not to splash when you go in.
Isana went to the rail and looked down at the sea beneath them. She had never actually gone swimming in it, much less engaged in watercrafting using salt water as a medium. She had heard that there were almost no practical differences in working with fresh water or salt water. Almost hardly seemed a comforting word, given that her watercraft was the only thing standing between them and a number of extremely violent, unpleasant forms of death. For a moment Isana felt her hands start shaking. What in the world was she thinking? She was no knight, nor soldier, nor mercenary, to go hurling herself into the deadly sea for the express purpose of murdering two men whom she had never met, nor who had ever done her harm. She was a steadholder, used to running a farm, and half of the time she'd had that position, she'd been travelling around the realm for one reason or another. What could possibly make her think that she was capable of doing something like this? Isana caught herself before all the anxiety and rising apprehension around her overwhelmed her thoughts. She took a deep breath, called to Rill, and lowered herself into the sea, parting the water beneath her so that she entered with hardly a ripple, much less a splash. She stayed under for a moment, using the bond with her fury to reach out around her in the water. The sea was warmer than she expected, and there was a greater sense of buoyancy than in the cold streams and lakes of her home. She closed her eyes for a moment, focusing on the water around her, and immediately felt the presence of the Furies laboring for the Slive's witchmen. It was crafting of considerable complexity and effort, allowing the ship to cut smoothly through the waters while simultaneously smoothing those waters only a few feet from the hulls. Isana had no idea if she herself could have managed it, and certainly she couldn't have done it for any length of time. The witchmen kept it up on a continual basis. It was a specialist's form of crafting, then, something that took time to practice and master. It was probably why the witchmen remained so isolated from the rest of the ship, down in the depths of the hold, as close to the water and as far from the distracting emotions of their crewmates as possible. She took a slow breath and felt Rill filtering the water. The air tasted slightly of minerals, like the hot springs in the Calderon Valley, but she had no particular difficulty. She willed herself forward and rushed through the water, banked in a half-circle, and returned to the side of the Slive. It was somewhat daunting how much water was around her. Isana had never been swimming in so much water that she could not feel either shoreline and the floor of the lake or river she was in. Here in the sea, the water stretched out in every direction for as far as her senses could reach, endless rolling blue all around her, and endless grave cold blackness beneath her. The water was disturbed behind and beneath her, and Isana darted to one side, just as a smooth, sleek form more than 10 feet long glided through the water she'd recently occupied. She saw a dark, glassy eye, and a mouth of jagged teeth, and then the shark was past her, and it vanished into the murky ocean in utterly silent grace. Isana took a moment to deliberately extend her senses, so that she would have at least a little more warning should another shark attempt such a thing, and tried to slow down her wildly beating heart. Then she rose to the surface beside the ship. Araris was halfway down the rope, leaning down, his expression drawn with worry. She met his eyes and tried to smile at him.
"Are you all right?" he murmured.
She lifted a finger to her lips as she nodded and beckoned him. Araris turned and lowered himself hand over hand down the rest of the rope, the sinews in his back and shoulders rippling. He kept going once his feet hit the water and slid in slowly and quietly. The rest of them came down the same way, except for Aaron, whose grip slipped halfway down the line. Isana was ready for it, and Rill was ready to receive him, a vaguely human shape rising from the waves to catch Aaron and lower him soundlessly into the water.
"All right," Tavi murmured.
He treaded water beside Isana and seized one of the ropes on her harness.
"Everyone grab hold. We need to hurry."
Isana turned toward the enemy ship as the slaves sailed on, and the others maneuvered through the water to catch hold of the trailing lines. It took them longer than she would have thought, and she felt the faint fluttering sensation of at least 2 more sharks circling 50 or 60 feet away.
"All right, let's go," Tavi murmured.
She felt his hand touch her shoulder and squeeze once. His fear came pouring through his touch, but so did a sense of almost eager elation. Great furies save her. The boy was enjoying himself.
"Deep breaths, everyone," Isana said.
She waited a beat, then she oriented on the receding form of the Mactus, reached out to Rill, and dived. She noticed immediately how much more effort it took to move. A glance over her shoulder showed her that everyone was holding on with both hands, and stripped down to trousers, their bodies moved through the water as smoothly as they could. Even so, the additional weight and resistance to movement was considerable. Isana ground her teeth. At this rate, it would take even longer than Deimos's estimate to reach the Mactus, and the others didn't have her ability to breathe while underwater. Surfacing too near the enemy ship would be suicide, and if they stopped to discuss it, the Mactus might have sailed beyond her ability to catch up. There was no help for it. She closed her eyes and redoubled her efforts, spreading more of her fury's attention into the water around her charges so that they cut through it more efficiently. Slowly they began to pick up speed. The sensation of her bond with Rill became something tangible, a pressure on her temples, and she bent all her attention to her task. She almost didn't notice it, but Rill's sudden warning made her bank sharply to avoid ramming something large and dark. She followed the contours of the object, pressing ahead. Its surface was odd, pebbly, and laced with barnacles and straggling hair-fine bits of dark green seaweed. They passed along it for several seconds before it dawned on Isana that they were within arm's reach of a leviathan. Her heart leapt into her throat, crashed back down into her belly, and began beating very quickly. The creature was huge. It literally stretched out of sight in every direction she looked. They were passing along what might have been a tail, she supposed, a long column of flesh and hide, ridged with bony, protruding plates down its center. Ahead of her she saw a protuberance of some kind. Then they passed over what might have been a flipper, broader than the slive, its end impossible to see in the murky water. Next she passed several rows of what looked like trenches, or perhaps extra broad furrows in a field. Ribs. They were the creature's ribs. There was a dull, heavy throb in the water pressing rhythmically against her, and Isana realized that she could actually feel the beating of the leviathan's gargantuan heart. They continued on, passing another flipper and then another column of flesh that must have been the leviathan's neck. The whole of the beast, then, must look something like an elongated turtle with no shell. Its head came into sight. Its skull was very nearly as large as the enormous stone barn back on her steadhold, a structure that could house 200 various animals, the farm's equipment, and stored food besides. It, too, was almost turtle-like, complete with a jagged-edged beak. Each eye was the size of a small cottage, great glassy black orbs that were almost entirely closed. From its mouth hung bits of what Isana could only assume was some kind of pale flesh. Whale blubber, perhaps? Even as Isana watched, a chunk the size of an ox cart fell with deliberate grace from the leviathan's maw, and was promptly set upon by a veritable cloud of smaller fish, only to scatter from the path of a dozen sharks. Rill warned Isana of several more sharks nearby, but out of sight in the murk, all of them arrowing toward the free meal. Isana's heart beat even faster, and she tried to increase their pace again, desperate to avoid tempting the hungry sharks with the others, literally dangling like bait on a line.